Good morning. Today, the legislature is considering many bills aimed at creating a funding mechanism for low-income housing rentals. We'll get an assessment from the street from one of the homeless service providers, Mental Health Kukua's CEO Greg Payton. If you were convicted of a crime you didn't commit, how would you react to your exoneration 40 years later? We'll talk with Ricky Jackson, who lived through that nightmare in Ohio and is in Hawaii this week to speak about the innocent who are incarcerated here. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Vocalist Dee Dee Bridgewater has spent more than 40 years at the forefront of the jazz scene, and she'll share a few secrets. And artist Carly Capp makes novices through an introduction to block printing.
It's Thursday, February 11th. Those conversations and a few more coming up on The Conversation right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
The legislature is going to look at affordable housing today, huh?
Well, today and probably many days afterward,
well,
too.
Let's hope
but
so.
There are a lot of bills this year. Now, if you talk to just about anyone about homelessness, the words affordable housing come up pretty quickly. And although available housing units at economic levels from low to middle incomes are well behind needs, the call for units for people trying to get off the street is particularly acute. As the logic goes, not enough permanent housing means that shelters bottleneck as people wait for units. Today, a slew of bills with proposed streams of funding are up for consideration in the legislature. We asked Greg Payton, CEO of Mental Health Kukua, and also the chair of the Advocacy Committee for Partners in Care, to take an assessment or give us an assessment of all of these bills, which this year, Greg, seem to be well and above what we've seen in past.
A lot more than usual, Beth, and thank you again for having us on. Yeah, usually we Partners in Care as a coalition of about 30 nonprofit homeless providers on Oahu. We usually track anywhere from, 10 to 12 bills that we're looking at in particular that are significant to us. And this year, there's over 31 that we're tracking, so it's a lot.
That's put a lot of additional pressure to be able to understand what the bills are proposing and the nuances and the shades of each. And some of them are still sort of developing and morphing, and we'll continue to do that as we move into the second half of the session. But as you look at these bills now and the funding mechanisms that are being proposed, is this a good attempt and a good faith attempt on the part of the legislature to grapple with the fact that we have so few permanent housing units?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, I think what we're all impressed with is the level of understanding and education that the elected officials have. Many times we have to go in and explain what the issues are and what we're doing. But this last year, I think everyone has really seen what this is a priority issue for Hawaii is homelessness. And so I'm just so impressed with the level of education of many of the elected officials. The bills that are out there, they all have a theme to them, and they have a beginning, middle, and end. So it's about outreach, it's about placement, it's about sustainability. And I'm very impressed that they understand the breadth and scope of what homelessness means.
We're not just talking about one brand of homelessness. Clearly, as you look at these bills, those people who need just a little bit more to be able to make themselves economically sustainable, those people who are chronically homeless and need to have many more services but might have a better chance of it with, say, Housing First. There is some Housing First money in there. That would be, what, about $3 million to help families?
About $3 million more dollars this year. And so if you kind of do the math, it's about $1,000 a month we're looking at for a single unit, and about $12,000 a year. So it comes out to be about 250 placements with that kind of money for this next year. And you're right. And everyone seems to get this now. There are basically kind of three big buckets of categories of people for homelessness. They're pretty broad. But a little bit more than 30% of the people have those what you call chronic homelessness, what we refer to as the people that have been homeless for more than 12 months and are out there on the streets. Then there's about 40%, a little more than that, of people who are what we call rapid rehousing, And that's many of those folks are out there. They're working poor. They just can't afford a place to live. And then there's another group called mainstream housing, and those are the people that are people who have just recently fallen into homelessness, and oftentimes those are families.
Given that breakdown, having a little bit of money to help a significant chunk of that would obviously help a great deal. Only looking at it over a year period of time, though, is that enough to be able to cope with it? I mean, we were talking to Jennifer Ho when she was here about a week and a half ago from HUD in Washington. She's the secretary or assistant secretary to Secretary Julian Castro, and she was saying that she thinks that there should be more of a long-range plan, that we're really not there yet, but there are a lot of good things in motion. How do we get this, these bits and pieces that we're seeing in these bills to fit into a long-range comprehensive plan that means we can really slice and dice homelessness down to, veritable zero?
What I think, what I'm encouraged by is the fact that people now get it and they see what the issues are. There's that homelessness is kind of a complicated issue, and how you place people into housing and how you get them there is the key point. And so what I'm encouraged by is that there's attention to the various levels, like you were just talking about, the chronic homelessness. We're also looking at what we call rapid rehousing, and that's for some extra income for people who are actually working. Working homeless who can't make enough money to actually pay for a place to live. And there's a number of those folks. We've talked about this on the show before. There's about 400 people that live in their car each day. So it's a significant group of people who, with just a little extra help for up to a couple of years, could probably live in their own place. So it's what I'm encouraged by is that there's some these funds I see is it's the beginning of a long-range plan. What will end up happening over time, which has happened in other cities, is we'll put funding like this together, and then what the long-term thing is, not just to solve to get it to zero, but then how do we sustain this by having an inventory of housing and funding so that we could place somebody within 30 days in the future.
Going back to the conversation that we had with Jennifer Ho, and I should say she's a special advisor to Secretary HUD Secretary Julian Castro, she said that she's trying to find some other ways of, you know, pulling together more federal funds. Are we going to see more federal funds coming to Hawaii, do you think?
We always hope that that's the case. We never know for sure exactly what's going to happen with it. Hawaii's been doing a very, very good job with this. We've made such significant strides in the last couple of years that we're very hopeful that we'll see more funds coming our way.
In the short term, though, we're looking at all of these bills. Are there some that you think are particularly good ones that, if you had your druthers, you'd like to see actually put into play?
Well, there's a few things. Yes, there's some bills out there for the Rental Housing Revolving Fund, used to be called the Rental Housing Trust Fund, and that is to increase units for people whose income level is at 30% of AMI. Those are folks who are area median income. Those are the people that are really very, very poor folks who need some help. And that's where where if we could increase those units, that's where the rent subsidies would come in handy. The shallow rent subsidies, that's a buzzword that you might have heard before. There's a couple of million dollars being proposed for that. And that's what we were just talking about, for people that are working that might help them get off the streets and into their own place.
Or out of their cars.
Out of their cars, yes. And then there's some unique money out there that's very, very important. There's a couple of million dollars for more intensive outreach, to add outreach services. That's how you engage people on the front end. And a subgroup of that population are runaway youth. The point in time count for last year estimated about 144 people, I think, something like that.
I remember we talked about that was markedly undercounted.
Very low, and there's a reason for that. The youth run away for a reason, and so they fear that if they divulge that they're a runaway, that they're going to be incarcerated or something bad is going to happen to them. So it's a very hard group to engage. That's why the added outreach to build trust and to find a safe place for them is so important. And they're such a vulnerable group. We know that 30% of the juveniles arrested in Hawaii were for running away, for example, and that nationally there's some staggering, kind of very alarming statistics. 33% of the teens are lured into prostitution within 48 hours of leaving home. I mean, that's not our statistics. That comes from national statistics. So it's troubling. And so if we can really engage those folks in Hawaii, that's going to be huge for us.
And that's really the gap group that we haven't seen a lot of attention going toward in past, but seems to be gaining momentum, and we hope this year we'll bring some more.
We have some wonderful providers who provide youth services with Partners in Care, and extra services would be just such an added addition to that to really add value and make this really work for kids.
Thanks so much for the overview. We'll be watching as we go through the rest of the session and talk to you as we move through.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Greg Payton serves as CEO of Mental Health Kōkua. It's an organization serving people with mental health and homeless needs on Kauai, Oahu, Maui, and in Hilo and Kona. He also chairs the Advocacy Committee for Partners in Care, Oahu's Continuum of Care for Homelessness, as defined by HUD. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's now 8:14. Coming up, Dee Dee Bridgewater takes a crack at defining the art of the jazz singer. But first, take a crack at your backyard quiz.
In today's historical backyard, we're looking at a tempest in a teapot, the kind of minor scandal that wouldn't even come up on our radar today. It happened in the pages of a small Navy newspaper published at Pearl Harbor in 1943. The wartime journal was mainly concerned with morale boosting, and with that in mind, it published a drawing of a blonde woman in the not quite altogether. It was a typical wartime pinup drawn by Alberto Vargas, an artist known for his somewhat idealized images of the female form. It was reprinted from the popular men's magazine Esquire. Trouble was, the Postmaster General deemed the drawing harmful and not in the public interest. Many sailors disagreed, and while the issue was being argued in the court, this small newspaper went ahead and published the pinup anyway. Our backyard quiz question for today: what was the name of the Navy newspaper that defied the censors? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Mike Spengel from Bluegrass, Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
If you tell me where you want to go, you know I'll leave you.
The jazz scene was a very different one when Dee Dee Bridgewater was starting out, appearing as a featured vocalist in the early 70s with the Thad Jones Mel Lewis Big Band. That put her in fast company, the kind that gives a young singer the grounding that can sustain a career for decades. She continues to keep alive the legacy of Ella, Sarah, Billy, and others, and she's in Waikiki performing through the weekend. We asked her how a listener is supposed to know these days just what a jazz singer is.
In fact, I don't know what makes a jazz singer anymore. I really don't, because a lot of younger singers are being called jazz singers, and I just kind of scratch my head a bit. You know, what a jazz singer was for me is a singer who was able to sing a melody, to kind of play with the timing a little bit, and then to improvise on the melody, either singing the lyric or doing what has developed to be known as scatting.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of young singers that I think are really definition forward.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, it kind of seems like if you're a little bit outside of pop,
yeah,
they're like throwing it, giving it a jazz name. You know, it's very strange. I think that what is happening is, you know, with the fast technological changes that we have going on, with music being able to be streamed and to be uploaded off of the internet, it's just created a whole new playing field.
Mm-hmm.
And so the record companies are beginning to go by the wayside. There are very few that are still standing. Everyone is trying to crunch those numbers. So I think that everyone is trying to put people out there, give them some kind of label, and hope that it sticks, you know, and hope that that person is going to be able to move forward with that label that they've been given.
And
that's kind of how I see it.
Yeah, and you know, the unfortunate thing about that, Dee Dee, I think, is that the labels are more about commerce than art, right?
Yes, it's exactly about commerce.
And that doesn't have a whole lot to do with art. And at the same time, when you were coming up, and I'm lucky enough to have heard you very early in your performing career,
mm-hmm.
it was there were mentors, there were examples around. There was a lot of person-to-person teaching,
right,
of the art. Is that what it was like for you?
Absolutely, absolutely. It was when I was coming up, I think I came up in probably what could be called a golden era, you know. So I started in the 70s, and you know, jazz singing in the 70s was really exciting, because a lot of the singers, and we could even look at some of Ella and Sarah's recordings in
yeah.
the 70s, we were flirting with taking pop material and giving it a jazz flavor.
Right.
And then I was part of, you know, the kind of young upstarts who were trying to incorporate other rhythms and other musical styles and genres together to create something new in jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became part of, excuse me, what were called, you know, jazz fusion artists, because we were trying to fuse other styles,
yeah,
with the music. But the bass, the root, was still this kind of traditional jazz singing,
mm-hmm.
you know, a la Sarah, Ella, Billy,
sure.
Carmen,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, the list can go on. Betty Carter. Betty Carter, I think, was quite a pioneer. I think that part of the problem also today, Chris, is we have less venues to showcase talent.
Yeah.
There are fewer jazz clubs. There are what is starting to come up, spring up a lot, are jazz galleries. So gallery spaces that become performance spaces in the evening. So we've got a few of those that are happening now, and that's kind of exciting. And otherwise, it's just there's kind of an underground movement that I've been told about. I don't know what's really going on in this underground movement, but apparently there are some spaces. I'm thinking in New York, this is where I've been told, where musicians and singers go to perform, and they're not really called like jazz venues or clubs or something like that.
Well, in a way, that's going back full circle to the birth of bebop, when a lot of that happened in or the loft scene, you know. What
this is true.
The music's got to, it will find a place to go, because I guess that's, you know, the drive is there. And Dee Dee, when I was trying to get at with the whole comparison to a singer and a horn,
mm-hmm.
is that it's, that vocal improvisation is a very disciplined thing. It's not this American Idol singing a bunch of notes that may or may not have anything to do with the key.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
that it's a real craft, and that's what I think we're both sort of concerned about seeing kept alive. Yeah,
exactly, and I do agree with you on that. You know, but it's a hard career.
Well, it's worked for you, right?
Well, it's worked for me, but what listeners may or may not know is that I left the United States. I moved to France. And I had moved over there to do theater as an actress, but I was able to start singing and to start doing small theaters all over France. And then, of course, that spilled into Europe. So I've developed a very strong European following so that I'm able to work all the time if I want to. And I don't have to necessarily be in the United States. You know, I've started to do these clubs in the United States for myself, but also just to try and help support the clubs. Because as Chick Corea had shared with me when we were riding in a car together in the 90s going to a jazz festival, he said, you know, that it's our responsibility, we who have reputations, to go and do the jazz clubs, to help the jazz club owners so that younger musicians and singers have a place that they can go.
Dee Dee Bridgewater, jazz vocalist, is performing at the Blue Note Hawaii through Sunday, and you can find out more about her on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
When there is a treatment for a disease but no drug available,
you have kids who need a life-saving drug in front of you and you don't have enough drug to go around. How do you make that decision?
The quiet life and death battle to hoard and distribute scarce medications, a crisis going on behind healthcare's curtain. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Four-wheel drives, helicopters, steel towers, and satellite dishes. It takes more than a silky voice to make radio. Member donors are the real backup generators for public radio stations. And we send our mahalo to Allison Tai of Honolulu, Pearl Nakagawa of Mililani, and Miley Beach Smith of Honolulu. If listening to HBR helps you face the world, help us with the hard costs of radio. Membership forms are at hawaiipublicradio.org, or you can talk to a real person during business hours at 955-8821. It took 15 years for Hawaii to get approval for a medical marijuana dispensary system, but how exactly those licensees will be chosen remains a big secret, and so is the panel that will make the choice. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
All right, so why all the secrecy?
Well, it's pretty strange, actually. Anita Hofschneider's story says that not only will the Department of Health not identify who is appointed to this selection committee, the ones that are going to pick the medical marijuana license applicants, they won't even tell us who appointed them. We're not sure how many people are on this committee or who they are associated with. And the Department of Health also says it's not going to share any more information with the press until mid-April. That's when those eight licenses will be awarded.
It seems on one end that you might begin to understand that there could be an issue of folks trying to lobby or go through back channels and apply some pressure. On the other hand, does that really justify not letting the rest of us know who is going to be in charge of selecting the panel, of selecting the licensees, and how those panelists were even selected themselves?
The Department of Health says that they got legal advice on this, and they did mention exactly that. They don't want pressure from the public. In other words, award this person, not that person. And they mentioned a fear of having the committee be a target of lawsuits. And they actually, they cited an exemption in the public records law that protects people against frustration of a legitimate government function. Let me repeat that, frustration of a legitimate government function. But we checked with the Civil Beat Law Center, and the attorney there, Brian Black, says, that just doesn't hold water. it really goes against previous rulings with the state's Office of Information Practices when it comes to public records law. So one wonders whether the legal advice the DOH got was solid or not.
And whether it's self-serving. For those who are feeling equally frustrated about the process, are there those who are willing to talk about that frustration?
I don't see anybody yet talking about that right now. Certainly we know that some pretty famous people have applied for these licenses, the actor Woody Harrelson, the Tetris owner Hank Rogers here on Oahu. But, you know, nationally it's interesting. Anita did check. It varies from state to state in terms of sharing this information about how applicants are chosen. But there is a concern about, well, is the system rigged? You know, without that transparency of seeing who actually makes these selections, we're not really finding out from the public's point of view who made these decisions. And that's where the real concern is.
Any lawmakers expressing their own frustration that we don't
Absolutely.
Know this information?
Definitely Josh Green, the medical doctor, Willis Sparrow, he's been involved with this. They'd like for those names to be made public at least at some point.
Those seem to be the usual suspects.
Yes, they are.
All right. Well, we're going to wait and see what happens with this. Obviously, we have no other choice because there's no other information for us to talk about.
It's
except
secret.
For those people who are, you know, willingly saying, like the folks that you mentioned, Woody Harrelson and others, who have said that they'd like to be involved with it. So thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Support for The Conversation comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA FlexPlus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
It's 95. Beth Ann, you'll be bringing us Town Square, and high on the list of jobs few people would want to have would be managing the state budget.
Well, you know, most people have a lot of difficulty just managing their own budgets.
Exactly.
And eyes glaze over when you have to start to balance everything just in your own household. But when you start to think you can apply those same kinds of rules to the state budget, you find out how quickly that doesn't work. So we're going to sit down and talk with Wes Machida, who's the state director of finance. He also, you might remember, was the executive director of the employees retirement system for the state. And also, once upon a time, he worked as the assistant auditor in the office of the auditor, which should be interesting because we're also going to be talking with acting auditor Jan Yamane about what exactly they're focusing on and her opinions on several things, including lots of stuff that made the news over the last year or so.
In a way, having that perspective, both a budget director and an auditor's perspective, kind of looking at it from a couple of different sides. Huh?
A lot of different sides, and also abusing some myths, because yeah. I wish we had a dollar for every time someone has said to us, gee, if only the auditor could look at that, if they could all take a comprehensive view of. And, you know, people just don't realize what the office can and can't do.
Right.
So we're going to talk a little bit about that and somewhat of a primer of what her office does and what they're looking at now.
Well, it's inevitably an exercise in the art of compromise, right? Putting the budget together.
Isn't that life?
I guess. So they tell me.
That's tonight. Life, the budget, and the acting auditor, too. You can join us at 5 o'clock right here on HPR2.
Good morning. I'm Makana from Kaimuki. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Find out more about the show at hpr2.org.
By anyone's estimation, going to jail for a crime you didn't commit is a horrible scenario. Spending 40 years in jail because of it, well, that's a nightmare. It's also the story of Ricky Jackson, convicted of murder in 1975. Last year, he was exonerated when the only witness admitted his testimony had been false. Ricky Jackson is in Hawaii to speak to UH law students and others this week. He joins us now in our studio. Good morning, and thank you very much for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Most people can't begin to conceive of what it feels like to know that you didn't commit a crime, you've just been convicted for it, let alone being tossed into jail for 40 years. As you come out and you've been spending this last almost year in this part of real life, the real life that the rest of us understand, how did you make that transition without bitterness? Because I look at you and talk to you and you just seem to not have any of that about you.
Well, it was a process getting to this point, but I think I attribute it to the fact that I had been given such a great opportunity at a second life, and I was just determined that whatever bitterness or resentfulness or hatred that I might have felt in the past about my situation at the time, I wanted to leave it in prison. And I wanted to come out here with whatever time I had left, and I just wanted to enjoy my life and be happy for a change.
There was one person's testimony who put you away.
Yes.
That person was only 13 years old.
At the time, yes, he was just a 13-year-old kid, yes.
How could it be that a 13-year-old's idea of what had happened or what hadn't happened became the defining line for putting you in prison?
Well, you would have to look to the authorities at the time, because it's almost inconceivable to believe that a young 13-year-old kid could dupe an entire police department and justice system of Cuyahoga County at the time. You know, and so I think it was a collaboration on both the part of justice and the police department, and they pretty much turned this young child into a professional witness.
They smelled a conviction and wanted to make sure it would happen.
Yes.
As you spent 40 years in jail, how did you live your life?
Well, you go through a gamut of changes, and I guess the best survival mechanism in prison is to evolve and change and adapt and don't allow yourself to stagnate. You know, and so I try to involve myself in a lot of positive things. I mean, it didn't start out like that, because I was filled with so much anger at the time and a lot of unanswered questions. You have to remember that we were originally sentenced to die. And so my family was gone, my future was gone. And so you first of all have to come to terms with, this is your life and what are you going to do about it, you know? And so you just go through so much, and you have to be strong enough to stay centered if possible and not get too high and not allow yourself to get too low.
That journey has led you now into a speaking tour on behalf of the Innocence Project, and you're here in Hawaii to talk about just that. What's the message that you think the rest of us need to hear when most people are quite glad when they see someone who has been convicted put away?
Contrary to what we might see on TV or the media, this does happen more often than we like to think about. I'm living proof of that. Also, there were two other young men whose lives were almost ruined as a result of what happened to us. We had 32 exonerations in my state alone last year, in the state of Ohio, 32 in one county. This does happen. And if it just happens to one person, we need to know about it. Somebody needs to know about it, because trust me, there's nothing like being accused of something you didn't do. It's worse than any guilty person could ever suffer through. It really is. I can't begin to describe the emotional turmoil that you go through knowing that you're innocent and nobody wants to listen.
32 people in one county in Ohio. That sounds like a lot, is it?
It is a lot.
Compared to a national
average, it is.
And what is that national average?
I'm not sure, but last year, 149 people were exonerated officially last year nationally.
Of which those 32 came from Ohio?
Yes.
I see where you're making your point.
Yes.
in Hawaii, we've had a couple of cases, some very notable cases, that relied on DNA evidence. That was not obviously the case in yours when finally someone came out and said, you know, long ago that wasn't true.
Correct.
In talking to the students that you'll talk to later today, what is it that you want them to know as future young lawyers as they approach this? Not that it, not only that does it happen, but beyond the fact that situations like yours happen.
The level of dedication into which you approach your profession is very important, because the longer you be in the business, it's, you know, it happens, you get burn out or you get desensitized, but you have to always remember that these people's lives depend on you. It's because of people like they are or want to be that I'm here today, because people were dedicated and they cared about the injustices that they saw being perpetrated in their name as citizens.
And what did that going of far beyond the extra mile look like when it came to your case?
I mean, I can't, the students at the university in Cincinnati of law, I mean, I just can't heap enough praise on these young students. They went far beyond the extra mile because they believed in me and they believed in what they were doing. And the passion and the dedication was just unparalleled in anything I've ever saw. And these were really young people, young, brilliant, bright, energetic people. And they are a big reason why I'm sitting here today.
But they did this as a collaborative.
Yes. I mean, these guys would come in on their free time and they would work on my case. They would have, I mean, and these guys were still in college. They were still had caseloads of work they had to do for themselves. But it was a process, but they stayed dedicated and they stayed the course. And finally, we got a break. But again, it goes back to the research and just the dedication that these students put into the case. And they didn't get a lot of credit for it because, you know, the lawyers are naturally the face of the business, so to speak. But, I mean, hopefully the students that I'm speaking with today will find that same passion and energy to want to do, go out and change their world, change their surroundings.
Do you know of any cases that these students are actively working on now?
No, I must confess to being, really naive about the legal system in Hawaii and how things are. I mean, you get a certain image about the place and it's really beautiful and I'm glad to be here, but you really never know that the other side, so to speak.
The underbelly.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, it's paradise without doubt, but you know, sometimes things happen, unfortunate things, and people need to know that they have a voice and that there's somebody who's willing to listen.
As you continue to speak on behalf of the Innocence Project, how else do you want to live your life at this point?
I get so much enjoyment out of just being around people and seeing where I can fit in and help, because I've been given so much, really, I have, you know, not just materially, but I've been given my life, and that's everything to me, and I really appreciate it, and so I just want to try to do the same for others, you know, people that need help and don't feel like no one's listening. You know, there are people out here that will listen, you know, and I want to be one of those people who listen.
To do that, are you planning to start your own foundation or your own outreach? I mean, now that you have not a lot, but a little bit of money that the state of Ohio granted you, that's something that a lot of people would think might sustain you for a while, but is there something else that you feel that
right now,
more to do?
I've never given it much thought. I really like traveling a lot, going different places and meeting new people and, you know, hearing their concerns and lending ideas and getting ideas. You know, I just like moving around and, you know, right. That's what I like doing right now. Just, you know, just getting out and going to people on their terms, meeting people on their terms.
Catching up a little bit.
Yeah.
We're catching up a lot.
A lot.
Ricky, thank you so much
for
coming in.
Thank you so much for having me again. Thank
you
very much.
Ricky Jackson will speak to students at the UH Law School on behalf of the Hawaii Innocence Project later today. The Hawaii State Bar Association and the Innocence Project are having a fundraiser at the Pacific Club on Friday, where Ricky Jackson will also be speaking.
The race to become the Democratic presidential nominee is all tied up. Bernie Sanders won big this week in New Hampshire. Hillary Clinton eked out a victory last week in Iowa. Later today, the two candidates meet in Milwaukee to make their case to the country. I'm Scott Detrow. Join NPR News for a live broadcast of the PBS NewsHour Democratic Debate.
This afternoon at 4 on HPR 1.
But before we get to that, we're going to go back to today's backyard quiz about a wartime kerfuffle over a pinup. It was an Alberto Vargas painting of an extravagantly endowed young woman that had drawn unfavorable attention from wartime censors when it was published nationally in Esquire magazine. The controversy didn't bother the folks at Pearl Harbor back in 1943, though. They went ahead and published the racy drawing in their unit newspaper and did so with full approval of the Navy chaplain who monitored the paper. The unit was the U.S. Navy's 3rd Naval Construction Regiment, known as the Seabees. The artist at the center of the controversy, Vargas, donated his original drawing to the paper and inscribed it to the Sea Beacon. And that was the name of the paper we wanted you to tell us today. And we had someone who knew that.
And the someone who knew that is named Robbie Dingman, an oddly familiar name.
We know her.
Rings a bell. But Robbie will be getting a T-shirt. Congratulations.
One to add to her collection.
Exactly.
It's now 8:48. That's today's quiz. And if you've got one for us, well, tap it out and send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
For any artist or aspiring artist, a new technique can liberate the imagination. And for Kauai artist Carly Kapp, block printing is a good pathway for a novice to pursue. Each student leaves Carly's workshop with tangible evidence of what they've learned. And she's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Carly.
Good morning.
Do a lot of the people who go to these block printing workshops that you do, is this sort of their first venture into that kind of thing?
Most of them don't have any experience, or they have experience from high school, so it's been 20-plus years since they've picked up the tools.
Well, it's kind of nice when people want to get back into the world of art and craft, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really exciting, and it's so fun to see what people create. I mean, we host workshops with 25 people, and we're always amazed about how different they you know, they don't have any expectations of what they're going to create, and they come out super excited and feel inspired, and that's fun to watch.
What are the first steps that they need to take, Carly?
Well, we provide all of the tools that are required in our workshops, and we try to make them really accessible to all skill levels. So for our block printing workshops, we actually use linoleum blocks, so they're super easy to carve. You get great results, and like I said, all skill levels can really, really benefit from this technique.
Linoleum easier than wood?
It is. It almost carves as easy as butter. So it's we've had young artists, maybe around 10 years old, that can even do block printing because it's safe, because it's so easy to cut. Unlike wood, where there's a wood grain that sometimes the knives and the gouges get caught up in, the linoleum's smooth, you get a really consistent carving surface.
Yeah, you just referred to a gouge. Is that one of the tools?
Yeah, it's like a V-shaped knife. So it will carve away the linoleum. Basically, block printing is a relief printmaking technique, meaning that the negative area of an image is what you carve away, and that gouge takes that out.
Is it best to start with a sketch, Carly, or, well, you know, how do you sort of go from that blank piece of linoleum and the tools to knowing what it's going to look like at the end?
A sketch is really helpful. You can also, you know, we have people that are tracing designs, tracing words and lettering, making signs. We've had people design logos, even wedding invitations at our workshop. So it's good to come prepared with an image, and then I kind of work with each workshop attendee on what they want to achieve and how best to translate that image or idea to the block.
So what you're going to want to have is the outline of a design at various, cut into the linoleum at various sort of depths of the carving. Do you get the outlines?
Yeah. But you don't have to come that prepared. Like, even if you just have an image or a photograph or a general shape that you want to create, then I'll work with translating that into something that's carvable.
Is the kind of block printing you teach on linoleum, is that sort of once you've got your technique together on that surface, can you then sort of take that and carve into wood and get with more challenging surfaces? Is that the progression that you go on?
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it's really good for beginners, and we kind of start with that because it's easy to carve, and we get down the techniques of multicolored prints, and it's a less expensive material for beginners, so it's okay to mess up and to try and try again, and then you don't have the investment of carving into a wood block that's more expensive or time-consuming to carve.
Well, yeah, you just, I can see, it's easy for me to visualize, relatively easy, as a single color image, like a black and white image, but how do you get a multicolored image? Does that take different layers into the linoleum?
You would actually use a different block for each color. So it takes some planning in terms of design of what you're going to print first and what's going to print on top of it.
Uh-huh.
So every color is its own block.
Now that could get tricky, couldn't it, in terms of making them fit with one another?
It really can. It's a lot like screen printing in a way, where you have to think in layers and layers of different color, and we have to do registration to make sure that you line it up right. And it can get pretty technical pretty quick when you start introducing a bunch of colors.
I would think it would, and it's, do you find that some of your students bring in designs that are call for, you know, that are just a little too intricate for a beginner to be working with?
So far we haven't had that. We have had some people do two-color designs, and once they kind of get the format down in terms of thinking of layers, they've been successful. So I would say a beginner can feel comfortable doing a two-color print, but I probably wouldn't expand on that anymore until they get that down.
Well, that's certainly, I mean, there's a lot you can do just with that, even just with a couple of colors.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to visualize some of the tools that you use. You have that tool you refer to as a gouge. That makes sense. That's what you actually carve your design into the linoleum with. How do you then press it down on a fabric or piece of paper?
It's essentially like a stamp. You will coat the block with a brayer or a rubber roller, and you evenly coat it with the ink. And then you flip the block over onto your surface, which can be fabric or paper, and then you lightly press on the back side of the block and then lift it up, and it leaves the print.
Well, you see, Carly, when you describe it, it sounds pretty doable.
Yeah, it is super accessible for a lot of people.
Have you found that to be, you know, have your students in the past kind of stayed with it? Do they come back and say that they've expanded on what you got them started on?
Yeah, we have had returning students that have so much fun that they just like the atmosphere of the workshops that they come back.
Uh-huh.
We had one lady design a logo, and she wanted to add more colors and words into the logo, so she came back to work on that. We also had the wedding invitations that were repeat customers, so that was fun to work with them on the design.
Well, Carly, it's always good to hear about somebody who encourages people to make art, so keep up the good work. Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Carly Kapp is an artist who lives and works on Kauai. She's a UH Manoa graduate with a degree in painting and drawing, and she's offering a workshop in block printing a week from tomorrow at the Princeville Community Center. You can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
I'm still struck by Ricky Jackson, and if you know, people could see his demeanor,
yeah, exactly,
and his way of being that is so antithetical to the angry man that he was,
mm-hmm,
at the beginning of that journey, obviously 40 years ago, and what's happened over those four decades to bring him to a point of understanding how he can approach the rest of his life and not feel the bitterness of being wrongfully convicted.
I mean, it's a journey that most of us can only be baffled by the sheer intensity of what he went through. But I had the same reaction to him meeting him this morning, Beth Ann, that he has a, you know, an affable, smiling demeanor. And that was kind of my first question I wanted to ask him meeting him this morning was, how can you, you know, be cheerful? How can you put all that stuff behind you? But he's found a way. It's a remarkable story.
Isn't there an expression about wanting someone else to feel horrible is like taking poison and expecting the other person to die, you know, and it somewhat resonates with his story, but we wish him all the best, and certainly the students at UH Law School today are going to hear an earful.
You bet.
That's going to do it for us for this Thursday morning. On tomorrow's agenda, we're going to get a status report on the support for Hawaii's charter schools. Hawaii State Public Charter School Commission's Executive Director Tom Hutton will be here.
And we'll take a look at polo in Hawaii, still thriving.
In the meantime, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us on our talkback line and leave your comments at 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And all our past shows are archived under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning together, and I'll see you tonight for Town Square, and we'll have a whole lot more of the conversation.